It's Morning Edition on 90.1 WAVE. Good morning. I'm Dennis O'Hare. Great to have you with us. On Wednesday, North Korea shook up the world with its announcement that it had tested a hydrogen bomb. There's a lot of question as to whether it was a device that powerful. Former Georgia Senator Sam Nunn is the co-founder of the Nuclear Threat Initiative, along with Ted Turner. He's also a distinguished professor at the Sam Nunn School of International Affairs at Georgia Tech. He joins us now. Senator, thank you so much for giving us this time, and welcome.
Thank you, Dennis. It's good to be with you.
This is, if it's true, a big step up in the power of the device that they set off this time compared to the two or three tests that they've conducted before. But do we know yet whether this is, in fact, a hydrogen bomb?
The information I've gotten, Dennis, is that it's too early to tell, but the preliminary estimates from experts outside government is that it was about the size of nuclear tests they've had before, which are roughly equivalent, perhaps slightly less, than a Hiroshima bomb. So even if it was not a hydrogen bomb, it's still a very significant test because it's testing a weapon, as we've seen with Hiroshima and Nagasaki, that is devastating and unlike any other weapon that man has ever possessed.
If it were a hydrogen bomb, though, how much more powerful would it be?
Well, that would be a huge step up. There's a book called Command and Control, and anyone interested in this whole subject and anyone interested in reducing risk in the world should read that book, Command and Control, written by a guy named Eric Schlosser. He says something is pretty startling. He says the difference between a hydrogen bomb and an atomic bomb like Hiroshima is vast. He gives a sort of eye-grabbing analogy. He said if you took all the explosives in World War II by all the participants, all the countries, and you included in that the two atomic weapons we dropped on Hiroshima and Nagasaki and multiplied that by three, that total number by three, that's what a hydrogen thermonuclear bomb would be. So that tells you the huge implications and power. And even if the North Koreans didn't come anywhere close to that, we know that that's where they're heading. That's what they're trying to do. And I would say that this announcement by them, though not shocking because they like attention and they don't have much in the world except a nuclear weapon, that's about what they've got. Their economy is very, very poor. Their system of government is absolutely unworkable. And they have a very unstable leadership. So I would say that even if it's a false propaganda being put out, which is likely, it's still destabilizing because it says to other countries that are neighbors and other countries in the region that this is where they're heading. And that includes China, who is ostensibly a real ally.
And China has put out a statement saying that it opposes what North Korea claims it has done. But with all of the monitoring that we have now and the intelligence services in the international community, had we had any indication that North Korea was close to producing a hydrogen bomb, again, we don't know whether they actually did, but we have we had any signs that they were that close?
Well, I haven't gotten an intelligence briefing on this in a long time, so I'm not speaking from that kind of knowledge. But I would say that we would have probably picked up a number of signs if they were really, at this stage, capable of that kind of hydrogen explosion. But the fact they've got atomic bombs is problem enough. And even if you didn't have atomic bombs, the North Koreans have thousands of artillery tubes, conventional artillery tubes, sitting within 30 miles of and within range of the capital city of one of our key allies, South Korea, Seoul. So even before they had nuclear weapons, we could always defeat them in a war. We could defeat them now. It may take 2 weeks, 3 weeks, 4 weeks. But one of our key allies would be devastated while that was going on. And so dealing with North Korea is one of the most difficult problems. And we can see that because you'll probably have some politicians talk in the next few days about various rather grandiose and simplistic approaches. But we've been through about four administrations, a couple of Republicans, a couple of Democrats who've been dealing with this North Korean quest for a nuclear weapon. And no one has had the answer. In my opinion, there's not a simple answer. But we have to work with South Korea. We have to work with them very carefully. We have to work with Japan, who's much affected by this. And we have to work with China. China has a huge influence on North Korea. They deny that they can control what they do, and I think that's probably true. But interestingly enough, Dennis, one of the things that is pretty clear, both our South Korean friends and our Chinese colleagues fear a collapse of North Korea almost as much as they fear the nuclear weapon, maybe more in some cases, because a collapse of North Korea, whether from military action by outside parties or from internal revolt or just from a collapse of the economy, would produce millions and millions of refugees heading both to South Korea and China. And that is something that would be highly destabilizing to both of those countries. So if we're really going to get serious about North Korea and putting some serious economic squeeze on them, and we've done a good bit in that regard.
Yeah, I was going to get to that because we have had sanctions before. They have had several tests in the past. The international community has condemned them. And the sanctions have been applied, and yet even if this is not a hydrogen bomb, it's some sort of device, and they appear to be capable of ignoring everyone. So what kind of leverage do we have?
I don't think the U.S. has enough leverage to really do the job ourselves. Neither do our allies South Korea and Japan. But the point is that neither China nor South Korea want to see a collapse. At one point, South Korea did, but they've changed. Once they saw what happened in Germany and how much sacrifice had to be made, and then they said, hey, North Korea is a lot better, a lot worse off than East Germany. And West Germany was a lot better able to absorb all of this collapse than we are. And so our South Korean friends are worried about a collapse. I think we have to have a lot more discussion with both our South Korean allies as well as the Chinese, who are reluctant to talk about a North Korean collapse. It's one of the problems. But I think we have to anticipate that may happen one of these days because their economy is certainly not sustainable, and their people are miserable, poorest people in the world. They have, when they have any kind of even close to a crop failure, they are in grave danger of starvation. In fact, I've been to North Korea only one time, but when I was there, it was pretty apparent to me they already had, at that stage, that was several years ago, but they were in pretty dire straits then and probably worse now. And so there's another aspect of the North Korean nuclear program that I worry about, and I know that our government pays attention to, and that is, would they sell some of this material? It seems to me North Korea is more likely to sell nuclear material than any country in the world because of their desperate economic condition. There are other aspects of the Iranian development that I worry a lot about, including what it would do to other countries in the region and who else would try to get a weapon. But I think North Korea is much more likely to sell material, nuclear material, that could be made into a terrorist bomb and put in the back of a truck and blow up one of our cities. That is a real horror, and I think that's something we have a stake in ourselves, and we have to work with certainly China, Russia, and other countries about that.
You just mentioned Russia, and we haven't talked about them too much, but is there any kind of almost like three-dimensional chess sort of thing that any of the parties, including ourselves and Russia and China, could be engaging in trying to say, okay, if we help you with some leverage on North Korea, is there some sort of arrangement that we would make on other trouble spots, Syria, for instance, or something like that?
Well, when you look at the world as I look at the world, and when you see the stake we have in the nuclear equation, preventing nuclear terrorism, making sure nuclear material is not sold by anyone in the world, and the 24 countries that have weapons-usable nuclear material, making sure that we try to do everything we can not to have other nuclear powers in the world. We already have nine, and that's highly destabilizing. When you look at all those things, you come down to two countries we have to work with. Russia, number one, not because of their economic power, where China has far more economic power, but because they have, U.S. and Russia have 90% of all the nuclear weapons in the world and over 90% of all the nuclear materials. The Russian warning systems are part of our existential stake. If something goes wrong with the Russian warning systems, we got big problems in this country. So we have to work with the Russians. They can destroy us. We can destroy them. And the fact we can destroy each other means that we're unlike any two countries in the world. We also have to work with China. China has had hydrogen weapons, thermonuclear weapons, for many years. So has Russia. And, of course, so has the United States. And the fact that a country can destroy you while you're having an hour and a half dinner, even at the stake of being destroyed themselves, which they would be, because we have plenty of retaliatory capability, puts them in a different category. So in my view, when you have disputes with Russia, as we do now, over Syria, but also very serious disputes over Ukraine and what they've done with the capturing and taking over the Crimea, those are serious problems. But we still have to talk to them. I don't think it's a sensible foreign policy at all, whether it's a Democratic president or a Republican president, to say to the Russians, we don't like what you've done. We're going to punish you by not talking to you. We have mutual existential stakes in each other's survival. That means you talk even when there are strained relationships.
Could that same principle apply to North Korea? You mentioned their economic problems. Are they less dangerous if they have more economic help from the very countries which are trying to keep them from expanding their nuclear program?
Well, that's the reason the South Koreans continue to, you know, help them when they need food, even though the South Koreans deplore what they're doing and to their own people and what they're doing with the economic system and so forth. So it's very hard to cut them loose completely. In my view, Dennis, we the United States have to have very quiet but serious discussions with China and with South Korea and indeed with Japan about what would happen if the North Koreans collapse, whether it's economic or whether it's internal revolt or whatever. Because until China and South Korea believe that there would be world support for that kind of very serious scenario, it's very difficult for them to, either country, particularly China, to put the kind of squeeze on North Korea that eventually has to happen. And the horrible dilemma is you don't want to starve to death innocent people. And so there's just a limited amount you can do to squeeze them. China has more leverage there economically because we don't trade with them. And Japan trades somewhat, but not nearly to the extent of China. And South Korea has some trade, but not to the extent of China. So this is not one of those things the United States can solve by ourselves.
We saw what happened politically when President Clinton tried at least the beginning of a kind of rapprochement with North Korea. Politically, in a year like this, is that even in the cards as a way to gain leverage with them?
I doubt if the political climate would support that. But some things can't wait on American elections. And when you're talking about nuclear dangers, you can't say, hey, let's wait until November of 2016 and get a new administration. It takes 6 months to get people in power. It takes, you know, that long to get a new Secretary of Defense and State confirmed. So there are a lot of things in American foreign policy that you have to have continuity. And that's one of the things that is very concerning to me when you have the kind of animosity we have, seemingly growing animosity in our political system now, because there has to be enough goodwill where people that are running for office are kept briefed, for instance, on what's going on in the world, so we don't have terribly irresponsible statements being made that are not based on facts. And that kind of dialogue now is, in my opinion, probably sadly lacking.
Is it possible that what we saw from North Korea, that this test was perhaps not solely a message to the rest of the world, but as you mentioned, with the potential for collapse that they have, was it a domestic political statement, too, by Kim Jong-un?
Well, Kim Jong-un is pretty unpredictable. He, of course, has murdered some of his own relatives. He wants attention. North Koreans, when they see all the attention on the Middle East every now and then, they've got to do something, whether it's a missile test. And the missile development is also a major concern. That threatens Japan and South Korea. So in many ways, what the North Koreans are doing now is say, hey, notice me. I don't have much, but I've got nuclear power, and you can't ignore me.
You said there are no simple answers. Is there a beginning for the international community, even as it tries to figure out exactly what kind of device the North Koreans have exploded here?
Well, I think we need to do some tabletop exercises with our Chinese friends over the North Korean, as well as other things. We need to have much more military-to-military dialogue with China. We've got disputes with them in the South China Sea. China has disputes with Japan about some of the islands in the neighborhood that both claim. But that should not prevent us from understanding that we're in a different era. We're in an era where weapons of mass destruction are no longer the monopoly of great powers. Indeed, no longer the monopoly of states. When you have not only nuclear materials that could be used to make a bomb by a terrorist, when you have biological and you have chemical, and when you have cyber that can be used as a weapon of mass disruption, if not destruction, then the countries of the world, particularly the major powers, but other countries too, have to start working together. I say that we're in a race between cooperation and catastrophe. In 2015, cooperation didn't run very fast.
It sounds as if you're saying, though, that the hope for, to use the term, denuclearization, which has been tossed around a bit, that really is not realistic, that it's unrealistic to expect that North Korea will scale down its weapons program.
I don't think that's in the cards now. I think it's the only thing they've got going. But I think in the long run goal has to be what we signed up for and every president is adhered to in terms of the treaty, the Non-Proliferation Treaty, which has an ultimate goal of getting rid of nuclear weapons. You got 9 countries with nuclear weapons now, and you may have another 5 or 6 in the next 10, 15 years. I hope not. We've got to do everything to prevent it. That's an entirely different equation than having U.S. versus the Soviet Union, even throwing in France and Great Britain and China that were allies. We've got a very tricky proposition. There's a good movie. I'm recommending books and movies now. I just saw it the other night called The Man Who Saved the World, and it's a pretty vivid reminder. It's a Russian and warning system where he had false alarms, but he didn't know they were false. And it's worth taking a look at, because it'll bring about a sobering assessment of the mutual stake we have with other countries that have nuclear weapons, and why it's so important that we and Russia and China and others work to not let nuclear weapons spread and that technology spread.
And real quickly, maybe a yes or no even, with the leadership in Russia under President Putin and with the Chinese leadership as it stands now, can we expect that will happen?
We have to have dialogue. We have to have continuous dialogue, and we have to continuously engage in a way that identifies mutual interest, even when we have disagreements. It's essential for the protection of the people of our own country. That kind of dialogue is essential. Military-to-military dialogue is very important between the United States and Russia. We saw one of our allies in NATO, Turkey, shoot down a Russian aircraft. That's a dangerous situation. And you can complain all day long about what the Russians did in Syria as well as Ukraine, but we have to face reality, and they have to face reality. We have to have dialogue. The same thing is true with China.
Is there any good news in all of this?
I'd say one thing that people haven't noticed very much, but it's been very important, and there's a lot of criticism of foreign policy these days, but one place where we've made some real progress is on protecting nuclear materials and getting countries to get rid of weapons-usable nuclear material. There were 50 countries that had weapons-usable nuclear material on their territory about 20, 25 years ago. Now they're 25. We've had 3 nuclear security summits under President Obama. The 4th one will be in Washington in March. This is where the leaders of states come together and say, hey, whatever else we may disagree on, we've got to protect nuclear material. We've got to keep it out of the hands of terrorists. The know-how is there to make a nuclear weapon, a crude nuclear weapon, not one that would be on a missile going through space, but one that would be in the back of a truck that would blow up in a harbor or a major city. This is an area where the countries of the world have to work together, and we are making progress. So it's not all dismal. The other bit of good news is people don't really think about this, but when the Soviet Union broke up, there were 4 countries with nuclear weapons. Ukraine and Kazakhstan had larger arsenals than China. And so those countries have gotten rid of all their nuclear weapons, Ukraine, Belarus, and Kazakhstan. And that is a very important situation. With the Ukraine situation as bad as it is now, if you overlay nuclear weapons in that country, if they continue to have them, it would be far, far more dangerous now.
Former Georgia Senator Sam Nunn, former chair of the Senate Armed Services Committee, co-founder of the Nuclear Threat Initiative, and a distinguished professor at Georgia Tech at the Sam Nunn International School. Senator, thank you so much for being with us.
Thank you, Dennis. A great pleasure.